Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton, author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, and you are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. Susan Spungen, the food stylist extraordinaire, will be with us in a few minutes. We have a brand new sponsor this season, Kerrygold. Kerrygold's pure Irish butter is made with milk from grass-fed cows. The rich, nuanced flavor makes it perfect for all your baking and cooking needs. It's a taste that says 1,000 words, including, it's the bomb. Personally, I'm just excited to say Carrie Diamond for Carrie Gold. And I was thinking if there's a Carrie Silver out there, that person needs to get in touch with us immediately. We have been on a long hiatus and are so happy to be back. New York City is in the middle of a blizzard, as a lot of you know, but the subways are running. So I'm here, and so is our engineer, DJ Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Carrie. How's it going?
Good. I'm a little nervous because it's been a while We did a show.
Yeah, long time no see.
Several weeks, maybe 2 months.
You're like a natural, though. You're like riding a bike here.
Oh, I don't know about that, but we will see. But thank you for coming in today. Was your commute okay?
Yeah, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah, it really wasn't too bad. It was a little slippery, though. The sidewalks haven't exactly all been shoveled yet, and it's still coming down pretty heavily. But like I said, we've been away for a few months, and boy, what a few months it's been. I'm sure a lot of you participated in the women's marches around the world, and good for you. For those of you who had to work that day, I'm sure you were there in solidarity. I went to the march in D.C., and I'm still really energized by what I saw. I have to give a big thank you to everyone who wore our Don't Touch My Pussy or the White House Kitchen Garden t-shirts. Dave's not wearing his today, but Dave, I'll let it slide this time.
Yeah, it's in the laundry.
We bumped into a few of you in D.C. and saw all of your pictures on Instagram, so thank you. And thanks to all of you, we raised over $1,000 for the Women's March Fund. And what else? We announced the dates for the next Cherry Bomb Jubilee. It will take place in New York City on Saturday, April 8th and Sunday, April 9th. We are expanding Jubilee to 2 days this year. Very exciting. Day one will be all the talks and panels and food you love. Day two will be a marketplace with book signings, demos, panels, and more. Tickets will go on sale Wednesday, February 15th at noon Eastern Standard Time. If you'd like to buy tickets, make sure you're signed up for our email so you can get the ticket link. If you want to participate or have any questions, you can just email us at jubilee@cherrybomb.com. Before we get to Susan, we have a very special call-in guest. It's my baby brother, Patrick. He's a member of the Surfrider NYC Executive Committee and the campaign lead for the Rise Above Plastics campaign. He's been working on the campaign to ban plastic bags in New York City, and he's trying to get the word out, so I said he could call in. So, Pat, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi. Thanks, Carrie. Long-time listener, first-time call. Always wanted to say that.
I know this is kind of nepotism at work, but we definitely have nothing on the president and his kids here, right?
That's right. Yeah, nothing on that.
No. So let's start with, what is the Surfrider Foundation?
Sure, yeah. Surfrider was founded back in 1984 in California, in Malibu, California. First and foremost, it's a network of volunteers. All the work I do is just volunteer work. We have 84 chapters across the U.S., including here in New York City. And we basically work to keep the beaches, coastline, and oceans clean and open to public use.
It is noble work. I know every time you have a cleanup, you do a lot at Rockaway. You guys pick up tons of garbage in just like half a day.
Yeah,
it's awful.
The Rockaways is definitely, for the New York City Surfrider chapter, the Rockaways is basically our local break. And we spend a lot of time out there, especially in the summer, doing beach cleanups. And yeah, you know, it's a heavily used beach. It's crazy how popular not only surfing is out in the Rockaways, but just how popular that beach is. And unfortunately, it gets very dirty by the end of a busy beach day. So we spend a lot of time out there. doing beach cleanups throughout the summer. And unfortunately, you know, plastic bags, which is a big topic here in New York City right now, is one of those main things you find when you do beach cleanups.
So tell me, what is the Rise Above Plastics campaign?
Yeah, sure. So Surfrider, you know, it's a national, and we actually have some international chapters, but the headquarters in California sets sort of national priorities, and one of those is plastic pollution and how to address it. But it falls to the local volunteer chapters to figure out how they want to implement programs and campaigns to tackle plastic pollution. So Rise Above Plastics is the national Surfrider anti-plastic pollution campaign. And here in New York City, we're spending a lot of time on this bag fee legislation as a means to implement our Rise Above Plastics campaign.
So we have listeners from all over the world, so I want you to be brief about what's going on in New York City, but tell us what the deal is right now.
Sure, pretty simple. You mentioned a plastic bag ban. It's actually not a ban, but the New York City Council last year passed a law to put a 5-cent fee on what's called carry-out plastic bags. Those are the bags you get at the grocery store at checkout. It was, you know, years of negotiation and compromise led to the bill. It got passed by the New York City Council, a majority of the City Council last year. Through further compromise, it was the implementation was delayed until February 15th, which is next week. But unfortunately, some politicians up in the state capitol in Albany, working with the plastic lobby, of course, have decided to essentially preempt or prevent New York City from putting its bag fee in place.
So what can our New York listeners do?
Yeah, so unfortunately, these laws that are going to prohibit the New York City plastic bag fee from going into place passed both houses of the state government, and it's right now at the governor's desk. So if you can, please tweet at or call or email Governor Cuomo and just let him know that New York City should its bag plastic bag fee should be protected, and it should at least be given a chance. A lot of other cities and states like California just passed passed the bag ban.
Mm-hmm.
But even these fees have proven very effective in reducing plastic bag use and litter, and encourage people to use reusable plastic bags, just like their Cherry Bomb tote bag.
Yes.
Would be perfect.
Yes. Made in America. Okay, so you are very vigilant about cutting down on single-use plastics. You are all over the family to not use plastic cups, plastic straws, all of that. Give us some tips for our listeners for cutting down on single-use plastic.
Sure. Just so you know, I mean, if you enjoy the ocean or if you eat seafood, then you really should educate yourself on this issue. It's becoming such a big one that it's actually threatening the food chain in our ocean. So I just really, your food listeners, you know, you really should educate yourselves on this. But the biggest tip I can say is be prepared for your ordinary day. If you know you drink coffee every day, if you know you eat lunch out every day, you know, get your reusable cup, get your own Tupperware, get your own utensil set, put those in your tote bag, and just have those with you when you go out for your day-to-day kind of living. It's, you know, especially here in New York City, everybody leads busy lives and is running around from meeting to meeting. And, you know, it's just so easy. New York City makes it so easy to use single-use disposable plastic. And the only way to really fix that is if you're prepared with your own stuff. So that's the easiest tip I could give people. Other than that, just really try to be a thoughtful consumer. You know, be careful where you spend your money. Go to restaurants, go to coffee shops that care about the environment. And that try to reduce their footprint and the footprint of their customers.
All right. Well, okay, bro, that's all the time you got today.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate it. And please, to your listeners, if you can, reach out to the governor on this plastic bag fee issue. It's really important. California banned them, and if we can reduce them, that's going to go a long way.
All right. And we'll do some social media after this to get the word out a little bit further. Make sure you tell Mom to listen to the show.
I will. Thanks, Carrie.
All right. Good luck, and thanks for fighting for cleaner oceans, Pat. You're the bomb.
Okay. Anytime.
Even though you're a boy. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
I'm very excited to welcome today's guest, Susan Spungen. She's a legend in food styling circles, as she was the founding food editor of Martha Stewart Living and co-authored Martha's Hors d'oeuvres handbook. She's the author of the book, What's a Hostess to Do? And she has brought food to life in major feature films such as Julie and Julia and Eat, Pray, Love. Susan Spungen, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for having me.
We have wanted you on the show for so long, and I can't believe that you were able to come on today.
I'm so flattered.
It's the start of our new season. Like I said, we were on hiatus forever. We posted on Instagram, and boy, you have so many fans.
Do I?
You do. I mean, I saw comments from Darcy Miller, Athena Calderon, Carolyn Carreño, Amy Chaplin, Andy Mitchell. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, everybody loves Susan.
I love them.
Aw. So here's an easy question.
Yeah.
Why does everybody love you so much?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I try to be nice and lovable as much as possible.
So let's jump right into food. We both got here early because of the snow, and thank you again for making it here.
Sure.
You started telling me about a cherry clafoutis you'd made, and I think that's on your Instagram, right?
Yes.
If everybody wants
yesterday.
To follow along. You were making in celebration of being on the show.
Yes.
And you were looking for cherries, and there are actually cherries in the market, which shocked me.
Yeah, there were Chilean cherries until yesterday.
So tell us about a cherry clafoutis. So for everybody looking at that photo right now, they know what that is.
Well, I mean, a clafoutis is like the most simple and classic French dessert, but some people think it's a little bit more suitable for breakfast because it's almost really like a pancake. It's just eggs, flour, milk. It's really simple. But I was never such a big fan of the clafoutis, and I actually developed a recipe a few months ago for Rodale's Organic Life, which is since folded, yet another magazine casualty. And it was actually a cranberry version. But because a clafoutis, I thought, I've had a lot of rubbery ones, so I was trying to make something that felt a bit more custardy. So that's the recipe that I posted yesterday, but with cherries instead. It also had candied ginger and sliced almonds on top. So I was just trying to sort of jazz up the basic clafoutis.
Yum. And now everyone's happy that they know how to say that word.
Yeah. Well, some people say clafoutis, but I think a lot of people say clafoutis, but I think that the proper French pronunciation would be clafoutis.
That's one of those intimidating words.
Really?
Even if you've studied a little French, I still look at it and I'm like, ooh.
And the S is silent. Yes, it ends in an S, but you don't say clafoutis or anything like that.
An easier thing to pronounce is powdered peanut butter.
Oh, yeah.
Which we were also talking about. And I only happened to know about that because when we were at Yahoo Food, I don't know, somebody sent us like all this powdered peanut butter. And I was like, I didn't even know this is a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. It was probably Peanut Butter and Company because they started a line and they sent some to me too. But my favorite brand, if I can say, is one that's called Just Great Stuff. And they sell it at Whole Foods and other. It's actually an organic version. And it's the chocolate is just like the best thing you ever had. And it's kind of really low in calories. So I indulge in that as a sort of treat here and there. And then this morning I was saying, even despite the snowy weather, I had a chocolate cherry smoothie because I came back from the gym and I was preparing to come here and I was a little bit hungry. So even though it's not really smoothie weather, because it tends to make me feel really cold, I made this, took some of those cherries I had left from yesterday and threw those in the blender with some other things. Actually a few blueberries and a few strawberries and some banana that I had frozen and some almond milk and then some of this chocolate flavored powdered peanut butter. And
Yum.
It made a really good, indulgent tasting smoothie.
And that's to add a little protein?
Yeah, a little protein and flavor. I thought, well, chocolate and cherry is sort of a good combo. I bet that would make a good smoothie. So
we really appreciate how much you are working the cherry theme there. For the past 2 days, not all of our guests take it to that level.
It's the least I could do.
And the picture was so beautiful. You know, we actually, I know you noticed because you comment on them, but we regram your pictures a lot because they're so beautiful.
Thank you.
And you're not just a good food stylist or great food stylist. You're a good photographer.
Well, I try. You know, I mean, I had an art background. That's what I started out. I went to school to study fine arts, and I was going to be an artist. So food came sort of second and kind of an accidental career, if you will. Because when I started out in the food world, it wasn't a popular career choice as it is now. And I did it because I loved it, even though it was sort of a lot of people kind of believe it or not, looked down their nose at people who worked in kitchens, and it was not considered to be the glamorous job that it is now. So when I started because it was sort of my second love. Art was my first, and food was my second, and it just kind of took over. And so I guess I try to bring the art in where I can, and I still am just a very visual person. So
it's so funny that you said glamorous, because I, when I was writing the script, I was like, glamorous food stylist. And I said, she's going to laugh when I say glamorous and say, like, it's really not the world's most glamorous job.
True, it's anything but.
But people do think it's a glamorous job today.
I think people do, and especially, you know, the film work that I've done,
yes,
which is the least glamorous of all of it. You know, I think about sometimes, you know, people just think that because it's, oh, Hollywood. You know, most of people see the Hollywood they see is at the Oscars or the SAG Awards, and that's actually the big night out for all the actors too. I mean, when you work with them on set and you see how hard they work, and also the environment that they're working in, which is the same exact one I'm working in, which is usually some weird, grimy, dark soundstage in Greenpoint, or, you know, I guess, or in LA, or on location. I mean, I've done a little bit of all of them, but it's anything but glamorous.
I was reading, you suggested that I read the article that Christine Mulkey wrote about you in
yeah.
the Times
yes.
about your work on Eat, Pray, Love, and the part when Julia Roberts is in Rome, and it just seems so fabulous, and everyone, you know, wants, dreams of doing that one day. And the reality, oh my God, it was, the weather was 100 plus,
yeah.
and you were in some crummy little truck under a highway.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd have to walk the food through tourists.
Oh yeah.
Oh my God.
It was really, it was very difficult. But, it, you know, in retrospect, it, yeah, I guess I could say it was fun. It was a fun, it's a fun memory. And, you know, I often compare it to childbirth. You know, it, even though I haven't personally experienced that, it probably is like that, because you go through all this pain in the moment. And then when you look back on it, you're like, oh, that was fun. You know, let's do it again, when you forget about the kind of momentary pain. But it's not really that much fun when you're doing it. And I also had to deal with some of the chauvinistic Italian chefs that were, I forget, maybe they came in to do like some of the background food, meaning for the other people that were eating in the scene, but not the food that was on camera. And they were just, and even the restaurant owner that, you know, we rented his restaurant as a location, they were really not very nice to me. So, you know, I, being a woman, they were like, how could she be the one in charge? And I had to deal with that in Italy. That was the only place I had to deal with that.
Wow, I hadn't even thought of that. And you, a movie set is not a 9-to-5 thing, so it's not like you were leading the Eat, Pray, Love existence while you were in Rome.
No, but, you know, I mean, there was some romance to it, believe me, because I, oh, I hate to say that now. you know, I was living there for, well, 3.5 weeks, if you include Naples. We went to Naples, too. So I had my weekends off, you know, and so that was really fun. And we were there actually over Labor Day weekend, and my husband came to visit over that weekend. So it wasn't like it wasn't fun. I was living in a beautiful hotel on the Via Giulia, and I had my weekends off. So
it was not torturous.
No, it wasn't. And I got to like get the experience of living in Rome, and, you know, just walking to the Campo di Fiori, and it was fun.
So
that
romantic.
Part was fun for sure.
Absolutely. I remember when I worked for a French company and got to go to Paris all the time, even though I would be going to these hideous meetings where I'd literally be in a windowless conference room for 8 hours, you know, when you're driving through the Place de la Concorde, you know, it's better than the subway.
And I had a driver, so that made it nice too in Rome.
Is the pizza really better in Naples?
It was very good. I mean, we shot at Don Michele, which is one of the most famous pizzerias in Naples. And it was really amazing to sort of experience, I guess, the simplicity of the process. I mean, you know, in the kitchen, they had, you know, 4 ingredients. They had the dough and the machine, and they had flour, water, yeast, tomatoes, cheese, you know, basil, oil. That's all they had in the whole entire kitchen, because it's just straightforward. And they make the pizzas in, you know, something like 60 seconds or so, very, very fast. The pizza oven is so hot. And it's National Pizza Day, by the way.
Wait, did we confirm that? Dave,
yeah.
Is that confirmed?
That is confirmed.
Okay, boy.
National Pizza Pie Day.
Okay. Oh, well, thank
and
God
we may have to
specific,
celebrate.
Yeah.
Thank
afterwards.
God we're at Roberta's. My gosh.
So the amazing thing about watching them make the pizza, if I might digress for a moment, one of the things they do in this blazing hot oven is they had like a handful of like wood shavings, and they would throw that in the oven just to like throw a little smoke onto each pizza. So it was kind of amazing to watch them do that. And they would just go in, they'd throw in the wood shavings, add a little extra smoke to the flavor, and then like within under a minute your pizza is done.
That's incredible.
Yeah,
they don't cook pizza that fast here, that's for sure.
Yeah,
not at Roberta's.
It's just really a hot oven.
So you said you studied fine arts. Where did you study?
I studied at what used to be called Philadelphia College of Art. It's now called University of the Arts because it merged with the Performing Arts School. So.
And when you went to school, what did you think you would do? What was the plan?
Well, you know, there was no plan. There really was no plan. That's the thing. I love to draw and paint. And so kind of stupidly, I didn't major in drawing and painting. I chose printmaking because, I mean, when you're 18, you don't really know anything, do you? And no one really tells you anything. So I was just kind of, and nobody in my family was artistic at all. I don't know where this gene came from, but I was kind of on my own. I had no real guidance. So I just started school, and I did take what they call a gap year now, but mainly because I didn't get my act together to apply for school. I was just really not a super motivated person when I was young.
Where did you grow up?
Outside of Philadelphia, in the suburbs.
And I don't think you talk about this very much, and we certainly don't have to talk about it, but Nancy Spungen, your sister?
Oh, gosh.
So many people asked. DM'd me.
She is, but yeah. It's not something I normally...
We can, like I said, we absolutely
broadcast.
Don't have to... we don't have to talk about that. But you also, you started in the kitchen.
I did.
Which surprised me. I sort of bought into the whole glamorous food stylist thing and forgot that, you know, when you started out, you were a trailblazer. You know, there was not a food stylist that you could look to and say, I want a career like X.
Well, there was Martha. And, you know, when I started, I had been in working in restaurants, mostly in kitchens, but kind of also in like these kind of bridge situations where, like, I worked in a restaurant in Philadelphia called The Commissary, where I worked out front with the people, but I made omelets or I sliced desserts or I tossed salads, things like that. So I had my very first experiences in the restaurant world were kind of where I got to do a little bit of both. I wasn't slaving away in the basement kitchen. I was out in front of people, but I was doing food stuff.
I love that you call that bridge situation.
Well, they kind of were, and I sort of sought them out, and then I did lots of catering, and then I was a pastry chef at a restaurant called Coco Pazzo in New York, and that was my last restaurant job, and I was like, I don't want to punch a clock anymore. I started to romance this idea of being a food stylist, and I saw an article in the New York Times that you can still look up online that was called How to Make the Basil Blush, if you want to look that up. It's from the 80s. And I read this article, and it was in the cover of the food section on a Wednesday, and I was like, I'd never even heard of being a food stylist. It was not something that... I don't know. You know, we didn't have social media then. And so it was kind of something I just wasn't really very aware of. And
wait, you literally got the idea from an article in the New York Times called How to Make the Basil Blush?
Yes.
What does that even mean?
Well, go back and look up the article.
everyone has a homework assignment.
It was just like, hey, here's a job. They were just highlighting this profession that not that many people knew about. And it was about this small handful of people that did it in New York. There weren't even so many people doing it. And, you know, and they talked about how much money they made, which I don't think has changed much since then. The rates have not changed much. But I read that article and I thought, wow, this would be perfect for me. So I started to get this idea that I was going to do that for my career. And you know, along the way, that led me to Martha Stewart when she was just starting Martha Stewart Living. And I won't go into the whole long story of how that happened, but...
We love long stories.
All right. So. Well, basically, I socially met Susan Magrino, who was still her publicist.
Oh, I love Susan Magrino.
So Susan... and I had a mutual friend, or actually my friend Kim had a friend, and I still remember his name, Peter Tannenbaum. And we all went out to Nell's, okay, if that gives you an idea of when this was, sometime in the 80s, late 80s. And
so Nell's was a major, major hotspot.
Yeah.
Nightclub, everything, yeah.
With a black door on 14th Street. And so we went to Nell's, and we all sat at a big table together. And I was kind of fascinated by Susan because she was representing Lee Bailey, who some of the younger folks might not remember either. But he was a bit of a trailblazer as well in the sort of cookbook world. And Martha and Lee Bailey were like the big authors at Clarkson Potter in those days. And it was before the magazine and all of this. So she, I think, may have worked at Potter representing them. And so I just thought, well, this, she must know about food styling. So I just started, like, I don't know, asking her a lot of questions and during the evening. And then at the end of the night, she gave me her business card, which I still have somewhere in a box. Because that's how I really started my whole career, was because of meeting her that night. I mean, maybe something else would have happened, but... So a whole year goes by. I gave her my phone number. I didn't have a business card. A whole year went by, and she gave me a call, no email, and told me that Martha Stewart was starting a magazine, and did I want to meet with her? And I was like, yeah, I do want to. Yeah, I do. I was like, wow, this could be amazing. I was just really, like, excited by the prospect of something. I didn't even know what it was. And that was what was exciting, was that I did kind of get to dream up my own career. Because the magazine was brand new and the job was brand new and everything was brand new. And so I really started, like, from that moment on, started thinking about, oh, wow, what could this career be like? And I kind of, in my mind, just came up with what it would be like. And over the next few years, that's what I did. I dreamt up my dream job. And
it was such a bold move on everybody's part, because magazines like that just didn't exist. There was no Oprah, no Rachel Ray, nothing like that.
No, Martha created this genre, really, of magazines. And I was just really lucky to... I mean, I didn't actually get hired as food editor until the third test issue came out, because they weren't fully staffing. And they actually did hire a chef as the first food editor, but I don't really count him because he didn't last at very long at all. And Martha kind of chewed him up and spit him out. And I don't even remember his name. In fact, I think he might have left the profession altogether after that. And I do remember that the reason that Martha really, really disliked him is that he ordered a case of kosher salt to go on a location shoot in Florida. And she just thought that was the most ridiculous thing ever. And that must mean that he was really not good. So he was, like, finished after that. And it was true that he was thinking like a restaurant chef. Oh, you're going on a shoot. You must need a case of salt. I mean, what was this guy thinking, you know, and shipping it down there? It was just like, it was kind of stupid. So, he was done for. So I, you know, consider myself the founding food editor, because that was before the magazine was actually green lighted. And I started on the very first official issue in 91.
What was it like? I mean, putting a magazine together is equal parts amazing and chaotic and all of that. And especially when you're doing something that there was no blueprint for.
Right. There was no blueprint. And that was, you know, it's, I think, sometimes about the current administration. I mean, but here's an example. None of us knew what we were doing or had done it before, which, you know, hope, but it was just a magazine. It wasn't the country.
It wasn't the world. It wasn't the fate of the world.
Yeah. But it's true that just because we hadn't done it before, it didn't mean we couldn't do it. Because there were a lot of really smart, creative people. And that was really one of the biggest lessons I think I learned from Martha herself, was that just because nobody's done it doesn't mean you can't do it. And I really took that sort of philosophy to heart in my career going forward, and I have really created my own situations as I've gone. I mean, even now, I mean, what I'm doing now, it's very much like a pastiche of different things, but I can tell you that many years ago, I imagined this for myself. But I knew that it would take a long time to get there, that I could do things that were project-based and do this for a few days and do something else for a few days and actually have a career where I'm actually earning money. And so those were the lessons that I learned from those early days. I mean, Gail Tau is another person who was very instrumental in the early days of Martha Stewart Living. She was the creative director, and I also learned so much from her. But she had been in the book world. You know, she'd never made a magazine before. But people were ready at that time for something new, and that's what we did.
We are going to take a quick break okay. to hear from our sponsor, and when we come back, we are going to hear about the post-Martha amazing career of Susan Spungen. We'll be right back. Do you have any fun baking projects planned for this weekend? Be sure to add Kerrygold Pure Irish Butter to your grocery list. Whether you're trying your hand at 420 Blackbird's famous pie crust recipe, Dory Greenspan's chocolatey world peace cookies, or Hot Bread Kitchen's garlic naan with green chili, you need quality butter to make these recipes the best they can be. Kerrygold's milk comes from grass-fed cows that graze up to 300 days, making it perfect for all your sweet and savory baking needs. You'll soon know why so many bakers and pastry chefs love Kerrygold butter. Hey, everybody. You are listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and we are back with Susan Spungen. So we were talking about Susan's Martha Stewart days, and we could easily talk about Martha for the whole rest of the show, but you've just had such an incredible career, and we touched on the movies that you've done, you know, not just Eat, Pray, Love, but you also did Julie and Julia, mm-hmm. which I can't even imagine what that was like working on.
Well, that also was like a new experience for me. I had not done any film work, and I had just been freelancing for a few years. And one of the reasons that I wanted to leave my job at Martha when I did is that it just was time to do something else. I'd been there for 12 years, and, you know, I just felt like, well, you know, if I'm here, other opportunities won't come my way. So when Julie and Julia kind of fell in my lap, I was thinking, well, this is the kind of thing that I wanted to be able to say, yeah, sure, too. And that is exactly what I said when Nora Ephron herself called me on the phone and asked me if I wanted to work on her movie. and she had gotten my name from Amanda Hesser, and maybe also Ed Levine. He takes credit for it as well. But I guess she did probably ask around. And because she was, I think, consulting with definitely with Amanda and also with Ed when she was, you know, researching the movie and researching, I guess, more of the Julie Powell side of things. I don't even know. But she, you know, kept saying, well, who should I get to do the food for my movie? And those are her words. I'm quoting her. And I guess my name kept coming up. So she called me herself. She said she had sent me an email, but I didn't answer. And she felt bad. She literally said she felt bad.
Wait, did you actually get the email?
No, I never got it because I think she forgot to put the .com or something, you know. So when she realized that I wasn't just ignoring her email, she thought she'd try calling me.
As if you would ignore an email from Nora Ephron.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I did not ignore her. And I happened to answer the phone when she did call me. And so, of course, you know, I tend to just say yes to a lot of when something sounds even vaguely interesting, my first answer is never no, or maybe. It's usually just yes. And then I say yes and ask questions later because I like to show my interest and enthusiasm for the project. I mean, you could always, if something goes wrong, you could always drop out. But my initial reaction is to say yes.
But it's, you know, I'm just kind of putting the pieces together now. You have had this incredible career, but when you think about just, I mean, you are an A-list food stylist and you have worked with so many A-list people, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's Martha or Nora Ephron,
right.
Julia Roberts,
yeah.
Meryl Streep. I mean, it's you must have learned so much from just observing all these people.
Definitely. And I, you know, somehow I am always, you know, I don't know if in the shadow is really the right word, but I mean, in some ways I've been in the shadow of great women, you know, so it's not always been so much about me, you know, and, but I have, of course, learned an incredible amount. And just to be in the presence of some of these women, I would add Nancy Myers, the director, to that. So I've had the incredible good fortune to work with so many amazing and successful women.
What was it like watching Nora and Meryl?
Well, they had a very good relationship and rapport. I mean, the great and poignant thing about working with Nora Ephron on Julie and Julia is that none of us knew that she was sick when we were working on the movie, but she was. You know, she knew that it was kind of her swan song, but no one on the movie knew this. And so when you look back on the experience, it just takes on a bit of a different color. But, you know, Meryl, had worked with and even played Nora in Heartburn. And, I mean, you know.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I need to reread that book.
Yeah. So they had a very good rapport mm-hmm. and relationship. Mm-hmm. And
you worked your tail off on that movie.
Yes.
I read some of the articles you wrote about it and just having to make like 50 roast chickens or something?
No, chickens were for, it's complicated, the 50 chickens.
Ah, okay.
And people like numbers, so that's why these things end up in print, you know, because they say, well, how many did you have to make?
And what's your biggest, what's kind of the funniest thing that happened to you on set for Julie and Julia?
Julie and Julia. You know, it's been a while. Funny. Well, you know, people always want like mishaps, but they're really, you know, even the mishaps were hard to do. Like, you know, there's a scene where there's supposed to be this, you know, aspic sliding onto the floor. And, you know, but all of those we had to like, you know, really rehearse with Amy Adams and the special effects guy and to make them sufficiently like disaster-like, you know, because it was kind of hard to, it's kind of hard to make things go wrong because I spend all my time trying to make everything go right.
And look more or less perfect, right?
Well, no, in Julie and Julia, I mean, a lot of times things were supposed to be.
Oh no, I mean, as a food stylist.
Oh like yes, normally, but in Julie and Julia, there were a lot of things that were supposed to look bad because Julie Powell, the character Julie Powell, was supposed to be not so, you know, such a great cook, and she had a bunch of disasters. She drops the chicken on the floor. She, you know, the aspic has, you know, there were a lot of sort of mishaps. So mm-hmm. you know, we had to kind of craft those.
And you know, that just got me thinking. There are trends in food styling, mm-hmm. and you've been doing this long enough that you've certainly seen, you know, it's from the early Martha days,
right.
you know, when things look perfect and beautiful
right.
to a sort of more messy aesthetic.
Right. Absolutely.
Where are things right now?
Oh, I think very natural and, you know, messy is still very popular. And I think it's very sort of, you know, I guess real and soulful and, you know, sometimes too, to an extreme. Sometimes it can be too much, but
what do you mean by that?
Oh gosh. I mean, I see a lot of people post on Instagrams, like they'll do this smoothie that's like intentionally like running over.
Oh, I don't get that.
Yeah. Like for instance, yes. you know, so it can go too far sometimes, or it can look contrived. So I still prefer something that feels natural. Not like they're, you know, trying so hard to make something look messy. But if you look back in early Martha, you will see it wasn't always so perfect. We always sort of embrace the messy. So I think you know, I want to also credit Maria Robledo, who's a wonderful photographer and friend of mine, who was one of the sort of original Martha photographers, with really kind of, I think she had a big part in starting that sort of messy and natural trend because, you know, she taught me so much because I was learning on the job and she'd always be like, well, put a few crumbs there, put, you know, do this, do that. Let's mess it up a little. Or she would, you know, mess up the linen in this very kind of sexy way. And that was like her thing. And I feel like lots of people picked up on that and embraced that. And that I feel like grew into, that was the seed that grew into the mighty oak that we have today of messy food styling.
I think you need a sweatshirt or something that says embrace the messy.
Yeah.
I like that as a message.
Yeah, or I think I said messy is the new black when I did like this blogger event for Julie and Julia, to promote Julie and Julia, and that got quoted a lot, actually.
So when you look at those smoothies that are running,
yeah,
inexplicably running down,
yeah,
the side of the glasses, do you think, this is all my fault?
No.
You take no blame. So you also work on cookbooks.
And
I found out very recently that you worked on my friend Carolyn Carreño's cookbook.
Oh, yes, I did. That's true. And I was listening to some podcasts in preparation for today. And I realized when you said you shared a room with her in Sagaponack and that Rufus was there, I was like, oh, finally I realized it was Pavia's house, right?
It was Pavia's house, right, right.
So, yes, I've been in that house. And
you have?
Yeah.
Oh, not when I was there.
No, I was there for dinner once or twice, mm-hmm, and I had a house just around the corner from there, so, yeah. That's
I missed the Sag House. I was thinking I might have to spend a little time there this summer.
Yeah.
But Pavia is great. Pavia Rosati, who a lot of people in the food world know. What's your Pavia connection?
Well, I think actually I just met her through that house.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I don't. And then, well, I guess it was the Daily Candy days, you know. And yeah, I just met her through the food world and that house. Yeah.
So tell us about, Carolyn sent me the link to the cookbook.
Yes.
It's not out yet, but, mm-hmm, but
no, it is. It's out.
Oh, it is out.
Her book is out. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Bowls
good.
Of Plenty.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I actually need to go buy a copy because I do like to buy my friends' cookbooks.
Yes.
Tell us about that book.
Well, she, you know, I don't even style that many books, but, because, not just because they're a lot of work. I actually like doing them because they're more creative, but they're also a lot of work usually because people have their small budgets and they need to get a lot done. So I do them occasionally. And so she asked me to do it and I agreed. And it's a great book that's, well, it's called Bowls of Plenty, but everything isn't really in a bowl. It's grain-based meals.
Yum.
Most of them healthy, but not too healthy.
Okay.
Like there's a bone marrow recipe in there and, you know, ribs. It's not really like, I mean, there's definitely plenty of healthy stuff in there, but it's pretty wide ranging and it's culinary, inspiration, I think.
So you talked about how tough the cookbook styling is. We just did the Cherry Bomb cookbook. Oh my God.
And you shot it already?
We shot it already.
Yeah.
We are finishing, all the proofing and whatnot, mm-hmm, but a cookbook is hard.
Yeah, it is. It is also a little bit like childbirth, I'm sure, because it is, and it takes about as long, if not longer. It's a big process. Usually it's about a year with the author and then a year with the publisher. I'm sure some people tighten up that timeline, but that's like sort of the traditional length of time. And, you know, I wrote my first book in 2005, which you didn't mention, but that one's called Recipes, a Collection for the Modern Cook. That was my first book. That was like what I did as soon as I left Martha. And when I didn't become the next Ina, then that's when I started really falling back on my styling work, because that was, you know, that's my main bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
So
we did get some questions from Instagram about breaking into food styling.
Yeah.
Alyssa Jasmine and Morgan Wiener both asked for tips for getting into the food styling world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think a lot of people are interested, but I think you do have to have a fair amount of kitchen experience. Doesn't mean you had to go to cooking school necessarily. I mean, look, some people are very good natural home cooks, but you need to be fast. You need to have good knife skills. You need to, in some cases, have good pastry skills. So, you know, some training in food is necessary. I don't think too many people are just completely untrained, you know, because I try a lot of people out, and that would be the best way to break into styling, I think, is to, you know, contact people whose work you admire and then offer to work for free. And because there's quite a few occasions where you don't have the budget and you need an extra body. Maybe you're going to be washing dishes most of the day, running to the store, peeling carrots, who knows? But I think you very quickly know, both if you're the person, the aspiring stylist and also the stylist who's taking a chance on you, whether this has any future. And I try people all the time who contact me on my website. You know, if I like the sort of, if I like their basic resume and the need arises, and it often does, I'll say, sure, come on in. And that's the interview. So
you need to be really smart. I mean, I love that you have a fine arts background, because I'm thinking, you know, you would want a food stylist who you can throw out like an Irving Penn reference, you know, to his like famous frozen food photo.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you need to know what all these different foods are and what they're supposed to look like. That was a problem we ran into. Mm. Like we have a labneh recipe, mm-hmm. From a Home at White Mustache, and I realized I'd never had labneh. So when I made it, I was like, is this...
You weren't sure if it was right. Well, if you were in an assistant role, you wouldn't necessarily have to have that level. You wouldn't, because I'm never going to say, hey, make this look like an Irving Penn photograph. You know, I'm just going to say, peel the carrot.
Or I mean, or more like when the creative director is
if
yells
you're the,
out something and you just want a food style. You at least want an assistant who's with it enough.
I think it definitely helps to, in any job, to be well-rounded. And it sometimes surprises me when I meet people on shoots that don't know much about art, because I feel like they're very interconnected. And I said something on a shoot not too long ago to actually the prop stylist, and I said, oh, it looks like that foam core, piece of foam core looks like a Franz Klein. And she was like, what? And I was like, really? You don't know who Franz Klein is? So I was a little bit surprised that someone who was into the aesthetic and the visual didn't know like one of the most famous abstract expressionists. Mm-hmm. But maybe that's just me.
Maybe it's just you. Maybe. And yeah, to be honest, nobody was really throwing out Irving Penn references on our cookbook shoot, but it's in principle nice to, you know, think that everybody would know what that means. Mm-hmm. Alyssa Jasmine also added, at this point, it seems to be a flooded market. Do you have any tips for standing out from the pack? Maybe what we just talked about.
Well, I don't know if she means food stylists or assistants, but I have to say there's a real assistant shortage in the food styling world. Yeah. A lot of us have trouble finding people who are good people who are available. Like, they all seem to always be booked. And so I think if you are interested in this career, that you just find a way to be an assistant. And if you want to, you know, work at it for a while, learn the ropes, and become a stylist. I mean, I think there's plenty of opportunity for people that want to assist, because I think there's a shortage, and other stylists would agree with me.
Wow, good to know.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, you heard it out there, all you aspiring food stylists. So it is time for the speed round. You listen to the show, so
yeah,
you know what's coming.
Yeah.
Coffee or tea?
Definitely coffee.
How do you take it?
Well, I take it with sort of au lait, but I'd make it really strong, and I add chicory because I love that taste. And so I have two big cups of half decaf with chicory at home every morning.
We have a chicory latte. I have a coffee shop, Smith Canteen, and we have a chicory latte there, and it's so good.
I love chicory. I mean, I sort of got hooked on the canned stuff. What's it called?
Café du Monde.
Yeah, the Café mm-hmm. du Monde. But I grind my own. This week I'm grinding La Colombe, which is delicious, and then I get the chicory on the side, because then I can have everything fresher.
Love. Sweet or salty?
Well, the two together, I think, is the ultimate combination. But I really do love both. So I think a sweet with the bit of salt is, as everyone has come to love, but that is, you know, there's a recipe in my first book for almond shortbread with salt, and they're just literally like crack. They're so good. So I think the two together.
I might have to make that recipe. One food you would never eat.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm just going to say brains off the top of my head.
You and me both. What's the grossest thing you've ever eaten?
Oh, the grossest thing. See, I was trying to prep for this, but
I know,
surprising me.
I had to throw in a few new ones.
The grossest thing. I guess I try to avoid eating gross. Well, actually, brains. I'm going to go back. I had to taste them because it was a situation. Yeah, so I'm not really that big into offal, and I did. But because a chef thought it was appropriate to send that out in a tasting menu, I had to at least try it.
If you were trapped on a desert island, and I know you're prepared for this one, with one food celebrity, who would it be?
This is a tough one, because You know, I'm going to say Jamie Oliver, though, because I think that not only is he funny and charming, but he's also inspiring, and I would always eat well.
He's a good one. He seems like he's pleasant company.
Yeah, I think he'd be good company.
Maybe he would cuddle a little at night.
And I think I like his funny words and things. So,
what are you reading right now?
Well, I'm not reading a book. I'm only reading the New York Times pretty much constantly.
If you had a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think it would be, I've often wished that I could just beam myself different places. So I guess it would be to, you know, what do they call that when you transport?
Time.
Well, whatever. I would be, I would transport myself without having to actually do the travel, because I'm not a big fan of long flights. And I also go out to Long Island all the time. And, you know, the drive is annoying. So I would just be able to snap my fingers and just be in a different place.
That's a good answer. They actually asked me that when they interviewed me for the Yahoo food editor.
And what did
job.
You say?
I think I said the same thing. I said like time travel or whatever it's called. Because just the ability to like pop anywhere.
Yeah.
And back to what my brother was talking about, not leave that much of an environmental footprint by flying everywhere.
Right.
That would be great. But
right.
But there, I don't know. That's a tough question. There would probably be other superpowers too. All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Susan, thank you so much for being with us. We're such a fan. We love seeing you at Jubilee, and it was really fun when Martha gave you a shout out from the stage at last year's Jubilee. Yeah. You are totally the bomb for schlepping out here.
Thanks for having me.
The Cherry Bomb team will be in Los Angeles next week, just in time to beat the snow, to celebrate the 100th episode of Radio Cherry Bomb. Can you believe it? This is our 99th episode. We'll be taping the show in front of a live audience, and our guests include editorial icon Ruth Reichel, Chef Nancy Silverton of the Mozza Empire, Sweet Bitter author Stephanie Danler, and Headley & Bennett founder Ellen Bennett. Tickets are sold out, but you'll be able to hear the show next Thursday. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and much love to Kerrygold for making this season of Radio Cherry Bomb possible. Kerrygold butter is made in Ireland with milk from grass-fed cows. It's a taste that says 1,000 words. Thank you for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
Claudia Sanchez, and I'm the publisher of Edible Queens magazine, dedicated to the food and drink of Queens, New York. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Tracy Ryder and her partner, Carol Topolian, who founded Edible Magazines 15 years ago. They had the vision of capturing the personal side of local food and to be part of the community that creates it. Over 100 edible magazines are published today in the U.S. and Canada.